Where are we these days with dealing with cancer? It seems as though the survival rates are much, much better now than they ever used to be. And yet we seem to be, or are we, no closer to actually curing cancer, or maybe even being able to totally prevent it. Today is World Cancer Day. It's as good a day as any to find out about what is going on. And one of the leading experts in Australia about it is Professor John Zaltzberg, Chief Medical Officer and Executive Director of Cancer Medicine at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne. And Professor Zaltzberg, thank you so much for waking up, getting up in the middle of the night to talk to us.
That's okay, Rod. Good to be here.
On such a special day as well. Can we just start with some basics? What exactly is cancer? Why is it different to any other disease or condition?
Well, cancer is a condition in which there's an abnormal genetic program that's occurred in cells of our body, such that those cells continue to divide and grow in an uncontrolled manner. So it's quite normal for cells to grow and divide. If you cut yourself and you heal, mm-hmm. When the healing process occurs, cells grow, they fill they heal the wound, if you like, and then they stop. And they know when to grow and they know when to stop. So that's very tightly controlled, and all of us have had that experience. When a cancer occurs, the cells grow in an uncontrolled way because of the abnormal genetics within that cell. And they don't know when to stop. And they continue to grow, and they continue. And when they grow, they ultimately invade other structures, other organs. And it's either the local growth or the invasion of other organs that causes the death of a patient.
Is there any part of the body that doesn't get cancer?
Oh, very, very few parts of the body don't. But, of course, they're much more common in some parts than others. But we don't have, for example, primary cancers of the heart very often.
Okay.
Most organs, including the skin, for example, can develop cancer. Of course, when we talk about cancer statistics, we usually don't count most of the skin cancers, except for the melanoma ones, of course.
Of course. Mind you, cancer of the heart is not unheard of. I think the drummer in the group Kiss died of cancer of the heart, which must have been a particularly appalling death.
Yes. Well, I think that certainly you can get tumours spread to the heart that occurs from time to time, but it's unusual to, it's rare to have tumours arise in that heart, for example. But, there'd be other examples as well.
Okay. For many, many years, I suppose, the greatest dream of medical researchers is to come up with a cure for cancer. That was the ultimate goal. How much closer are we? Is that ever a realistic, achievable aim? Or have we, in fact, reached it? Or are we just dealing with it? Are we treating it better? Is there actual possibility of a cure of cancer?
Well, it's a combination, really. Firstly, I guess we need to be clear what we mean by the word cure. Yeah. So if you're cured, that means something's treated and gone forever, never comes back. Now, when you think about many of the chronic diseases that afflict our community in this decade, so heart disease, arthritis, diabetes, then none of those diseases are ever, or very rarely, they're ever cured. If you've got heart disease, we learn to manage it, and people still continue to have heart disease. So cancer is also another chronic disease. But having said that, we believe that the cure rate now is of the order of about 60%. So about 120,000 Australians will develop cancer each year. And of those, about 60% will be cured of their disease. So, pretty well meaning that that tumour won't come back. Of course, the other 40% is still an enormous burden, and cure isn't the case.
But also the treatment, depending, of course, on what, the particular cancer it is, the treatment can be horrendous. I mean, it may save your life, of course, but people go through absolutely terrible, terrible time getting well again, don't they?
Well, look, I wouldn't want to belittle the experiences people have. And, even from the word from the very diagnosis, people are suffering from and in a variety of different ways. But remember, there are many sorts of treatment, and some of them are more tolerable than others. So certainly of old we used to think of people having chemotherapy and vomiting their hearts out and being sick for weeks, but that's much less the case now. There are very many drugs that we use to try and reduce side effects like vomiting and nausea and so forth. Having said that, you know, clearly some people do experience a very unpleasant side effects, sometimes even life-threatening side effects. But remember, the treatment of cancer is not just drugs. Sometimes it's surgery, sometimes it's radiation treatment, and so forth.
What about a vaccine? Is that ever a practical reality that there may be a vaccine for cancer one day? I mean, obviously with some, what Ian Fraser has worked on, they're possibly, you know, they're working towards that. But is it ever a practical reality?
Well, look, I think certainly for the tumours in which there is a viral cause, and there are a number of them, but cervical cancer was one of them. It was the preeminent one, and it's why Ian Fraser's vaccine is so effective. So because it's got a viral cause, a vaccine as a preventative is a very sensible idea. And in fact, you know, there is a vaccine now, of course, that does reduce the incidence of cervical cancer in cervix in women. But equally, that vaccine may well be useful for a few other types of cancer, oral cancers and so forth. But, you know, hepatitis, for example, is another virus. It can cause, hepatitis B in particular, can cause cancer in the liver. And again, vaccines that prevent people getting hepatitis B will prevent the development of liver cancer. So vaccines are a reality. Whether a vaccine will ever be developed that will, you know, you've got established bowel cancer or established prostate, you'll get a vaccine, I think is still not universal. There is a vaccine that's used or an immunological therapy that's used for treatment of prostate cancer that has recently been approved. But getting rid of it completely in the way that people might imagine a vaccine does is really a preventative technique mainly, and that's already here.
Okay, well, that's good news. And yet cancer is still the number one killer of Australian men and women, is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
Although, of course, I mean, cancer is a catch-all phrase. I mean, there are many different types of cancers.
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to use the word worst, but what is the worst? I mean, what is the one that I don't want to even say the biggest killer. What's the one that is most prevalent in our society?
Well, if you look at the actual figures in terms of the ones that are the most common, certainly if you exclude the non-melanoma skin cancers, we call it, you know, the very simple skin cancers that occur so often that in sun-exposed areas, if you exclude that group, then the commonest cancers are prostate cancer, bowel cancer, melanoma and lung cancer. They sort of list up there as amongst the commonest tumours.
Okay.
In terms of which is the worst, I think that's very much a sort of judgment individuals make, and I don't think we don't ever think about it as, you know, the worst. I mean, whether you think about it as ones that produce the worst symptoms or one for which the treatment is the most difficult, it, you know, depends on your perspective. But there are the commonest ones are prostate, partly because of the screening that's been occurring in the community, bowel cancer, which is which there is a screening program. We can maybe talk about that later, and then breast and lung cancer.
Okay, so those ones, the four most prevalent, perhaps prostate, which is, as you say, possibly because people are being screened for it, therefore we now know they've got them, whereas in the old days men may have just died having prostate cancer, but it may not have killed them. Bowel cancer, lung cancer, skin cancer. I would say also they are four types of cancer that you can do your best to prevent. Certainly skin cancer and lung cancer, you can take steps to reduce your chances. That might be a better way of putting it. The same with bowel cancer and prostate cancer with screening.
No, I agree. In fact, certainly prevention, there's several ways of thinking about prevention. Prevention from ever getting the disease is a bit different from the sort of screening. So screening we think of is picking up early cancer. Whereas prevention is, as you described it, is the prevention of the disease occurring in the first place. But certainly there are lifestyle factors, of which smoking is the most obvious example that everyone knows about, but to a certain extent alcohol and physical inactivity and so forth, that contributes to the development of cancer. And then a number of environmental factors, such as sunlight, for example, with respect to melanoma.
Our guest on Overnights this morning is Professor John Zaltzberg from the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre, or Peter Mac as it's known. We'll take some calls in a moment. I'm sure people have got plenty of questions they would like to ask you about this. Screening and prevention, so that's, we've talked about that. I mean, screening, though, is important because if you pick it up early, then that the treatment is easier. That's the case, is it?
That's absolutely the case. And, we're, you know, when people talk about, you know, prevention is better than cure, prevention is better than cure, but in fact, screening, the most cost-effective thing we can do as a community to reduce the burden of cancer. And as you know, there are screening programs for breast cancer, for cervical cancer, and there's a very limited screening program in Australia for bowel cancer. I think it's a pity that really that that's not much more widespread in its uptake than it has been, because it is a very effective way of reducing deaths from bowel cancer.
Okay. So should there be, like, you know, when I was growing up, and I'm sure these days with children, that you have the vaccinations and you get them all done at once, do you think that there should be a situation where maybe the government or whatever, it's funded by you know, Medicare or something, where you get a whole range of tests and everyone gets them done every 2 to 5 years or something, for looking for all these types of cancers?
Well, that's already the case for mammographic screening, say, for example, to prevent breast cancer. So, you know, you're at the age of 50, the screening programs start and people are invited to join those screening programs. In bowel cancer, as I say, there's a limited program that's currently available.
But what I'm saying is not that, okay, you know, a woman goes in for breast cancer or maybe a man goes in for prostate cancer, but at the same time, they can do tests for, you know, bowel cancer, lung cancer, skin cancer, any of those sorts of things that might easily be able to be picked up through a screening process, that instead of getting a whole lot done, you get one done, you know, at once.
Well, there, certainly that many GPs take up that role, so right. I think that would be an important contribution that the GP makes to caring for patients, and they would be looking for those sorts of things all the time, I think.
Okay, well, let's hope so. One of our listeners on the SMS system, and 0467 922 702, 0467 922 702, is there any significance or progressive research with amino acids? Tell us what's going on there. That came from Pete. Thank you, Pete.
There's an enormous amount of research going on, so very few individuals can tell you specifically you know, all about the research. So not, there may well be research going on about amino acids. And amino acids are basically the building blocks of proteins. And certainly there are a number of proteins that we use as anti-cancer agents. We do use amino acids infusions for certain in certain treatments, certain types of tumours of the small intestine and pancreas, for example. It's not the anti-cancer component of the treatment. It's more a protective thing. But so there may, I can't say there's no research going on, but the amino acids per se are not a terminology we would use when we're treating cancer on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. Why are some cancers more difficult to treat than others?
Oh, I wish we knew the answer to that, Rhoda. We just don't really know that. For some cancers now, and increasingly this is where things are headed, we're able to identify specific targets within those cells, which, if you like, are the driver of that malignant process. So, in other words, there's a particular gene, it changes in a certain way which we know about, and that drives that malignant process. And when we know those situations, we're able to actually develop drugs against that specific driver mutation.
Mm-hmm.
And that often is a very effective way of treating those tumours. And increasingly, we're seeing more and more drugs that are coming, being developed, which actually do exactly that. And so those tumours, some not necessarily are curing them, but it's certainly having a much more significant impact than they've ever had before.
Okay.
For other cancers, we don't understand what those drivers are, or there are many of them, and we don't have those targeted drugs. And so we tend to use, you know, chemotherapy, which is a bit less specific against the cancer cell compared to the normal cell. And that's where you hear about these various side effects.
I'm concerned when I hear that someone has pancreatic cancer. You tend to hear a fair bit about that these days. Why is that such a particularly difficult one to treat?
Yeah, it is a difficult one. I guess there are several components of pancreas cancer. Firstly, it often isn't diagnosed till late in the piece. It doesn't produce a lot of symptoms until the tumour's invaded the local structures. That's one thing. Secondly, it causes a sort of reaction around it. So the body starts to react around it. It becomes difficult to biopsy, and as I say, it's a difficult area because where the pancreas is located, it tends to invade the local blood vessels and lymph glands, and then becomes difficult to treat from a surgical point of view. When you use radiation treatment for pancreas cancer, there are a number of vital structures around, so it's hard to give the sort of doses that might kill every cancer cell. And then from a chemotherapy point of view, I guess that's one example of where there's been no targeted therapy, no identifiable driver mutation, as we said earlier. And equally, the chemotherapy is not as effective as we'd like. So certainly that is an example of one that's more difficult to treat.
Okay. Our phone number is 1-300-800-222. We are looking for, I suppose, questions. We've got one of Australia's leading experts on cancer, Professor John Zaltzberg, and we would like your questions about treatment, about cure, I suppose, about what is going on with medical research. And let's start with Margaret in Hervey Bay. G'day, Margaret.
Yes, good morning, Rod, and good morning, Professor. I'll try and be direct because I know there's many people.
There have got a lot of calls,
Yeah. And I don't know if the professor's covered this. I recently had a need to see a physician who ordered many blood tests just routinely. In his wisdom, he did blood tests, the professor will understand this, for CE and CEA 19.9, and they came back raised. So therefore, my GP then, because I've had chronic spinal problems, he ordered an IgM and CT myeloma and plasmacytoma. How accurate are those blood tests, Professor?
All right. I will point out, of course, just before John says something, and that is that, and Margaret, you understand this, I know that, you know, that what John will be saying is of a general nature only, and you know, of course, you've got your own physicians there and your own doctors who will help in your specific case. John, Professor.
Thanks, Rod. Well, look, Margaret, the blood tests are used a lot in the management and indeed in the diagnosis of people with cancer, and you'll have heard of the blood test that's used to test for prostate cancer in men, which has been somewhat controversial as to whether or not that actually is an effective way of picking up prostate cancer. With respect to your specific examples, as Rod said, it's very difficult to comment. But so the tests in general, though, we don't, you know, the average, we're not doing lots of blood tests as a screening tool for people with cancer. It's more that when someone's got a specific diagnosis, so you mentioned the word myeloma. In people with myeloma, they certainly can have some abnormal blood results. And what we can do with that is when they're having treatment is monitor the effectiveness of that treatment through the blood results. So blood tests are a very...
As a diagnostic tool, that's my question.
As a diagnostic tool, the effectiveness of blood tests?
No, certainly blood tests can be used to help make the diagnosis, and they can be used to help follow the benefit of treatment.
Okay. Thank you, Margaret. And, of course, we wish you the very best. Cancers and hereditary, how important is that? I mean, we often hear about it with breast cancer. Is it the same with many other cancers that maybe, you know, it does run in families?
Rod, we estimate that about 10% of all cancers have got an hereditary basis.
Okay.
So all cancers have a genetic basis, that is, there is abnormalities in genes. But in terms of an hereditary basis, so, you know, continues within families or related to genes inherited within families, it's about 10%. And the commonest ones, I guess, relate to things like breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and colon cancer. They're the examples that we mostly think about. But there are also, of course, increased risks associated when cancers occur within families. Sometimes it's similar environmental patterns, not just hereditary genes. But about 10% of all cancers. So we think about 120,000 new patients with cancer every year. About 10% roughly relates to hereditary factors.
All right, Paul in Sydney. G'day, Paul.
G'day, Rod. How are you tonight?
Very well, thanks. Yes, this morning.
Oh, this morning, yeah, it is too, and hello, John. This is more a good news story in reference to whether technically there is a cure for cancer.
Yes.
I have a son who's 11 now. He was born with a tumour in his liver the size of a softball. It's called hepatoblastoma.
Right.
It was a pretty scary time. The first 5 days of his life was a roundtable conference, what do we do? So basically we followed a procedure for a more older child, which was chemotherapy from 5 days old. Basically we had to shrink the tumour to a manageable size, which we got it down to the size of a tennis ball. The people were very, very professional. Can't say enough about them. Technically, no one will ever say that he's cured, but he's 11 now, and he's doing great.
All right. Paul, thank you so much. I'm so happy for your son. I'll just get John to comment on that. It must be heartbreaking when you see that happening. Someone who's born with a tumour like that, that's appalling, isn't it, John?
Yeah, look, it's a fantastic outcome. I'm very glad that Paul's son's in good health now. And although, he's 11, so you'd certainly hope that you've got this behind you.
Yeah.
I guess what Paul's son illustrates, though, is that increasingly the modern management cancer is not one type of a treatment.
Right,
it's multiple approaches. So it's very common, leaving aside that particular example, but it's very common these days to be using a combination of chemotherapy, of surgery, of radiotherapy, and in various combinations of permutations, sometimes chemo first, then surgery, sometimes radiation and chemo together, for example. So those sorts of combination treatments, we call it multimodality treatment, to try and overcome the problem of cancer is very common approach these days.
All right. Ken in Melbourne. G'day, Ken.
Oh, g'day, Rod.
Ken, you're about to have
hello,
an operation.
Professor John.
Yeah.
Good morning.
I just wanted to ask a question. I was diagnosed with pancreas cancer about 8 months ago, and I had an operation to try and remove it, but it wasn't able to be done at the time. And I've since had chemotherapy for about the past 6 months, and it's the size of the tumour has been shrunken greatly from about 300 to under 10.
Great.
And they're going to operate again. Is it more, could you tell me, is it more important the size of the tumour or the where it's situated?
Yeah. Ken, that's a good question.
As to removal of it.
Right.
So I think it's great news that the tumour has shrunk, Ken. I think that you've really hit the nail on the head. The most important thing about achieving adequate removal is actually its relationships, the relationship with the tumour to surrounding structures.
Yeah.
So we can remove anything if it's not going to damage the normal structures, the normal blood vessels, the normal organs and so forth. We can radiate anything to extremely high doses if we weren't going to damage the surrounding structures. So what's really critical is what is that relationship? And if you can remove the tumour without preserving, of course, safely the surrounding structures,
okay.
then that's what we're aiming for. And that's why that combination, again, you illustrated, of chemo to shrink the tumour, so now its relationship with surrounding structures is such that surgery is possible.
Ken, okay. We really wish you the very, very best. Everyone, I'm sure, listening is really wishing you the best, and I hope everything goes well.
Oh, thank you very much, Rod. I appreciate that, and thank you to the professor.
Thank you.
Well,
that's
good luck.
Ken in Melbourne. Yes, indeed. Look, we've got a lot of calls. We're going to get to all of you. If you're on the board now, we will definitely get to you. What about Chris? G'day, Chris. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, mate. You want to have, I'm sure a question that John may have been asked before. What's on your mind?
Microwave ovens, they use radio signals to vibrate the food and cook it.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any correlation? We're bombarded with radio signals now in our little universe, so to speak.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Is there any correlation between radio signals that go through our body and the increase in cancer?
Okay.
Of course, that's that type of issue has been prominent in the press with respect to things like mobile phones and so forth.
Yeah.
But certainly radiation per se, if we think about more broadly radiation, is an important cause of an environmental factor that causes some cancers. But specifically with respect to microwave ovens and microwave, we're not aware of any really increase in the incidence of cancer associated with that.
Well, I mean, people often bring up towers and power lines and all that sort of thing.
Yes, I know, and people are legitimately concerned about these things, but the evidence, as best as we understand it so far, you know, we've got no, from a scientific point of view and a medical point of view, there's no, we certainly want to know this as much as the rest of the community. The evidence that there's a significant impact, say, with mobile phones and towers and so on, in causing cancer is extremely limited.
Okay. Paul in Melbourne. G'day, Paul.
G'day, Professor. I was just wondering if there's any correlation between the rise in cancer rates over, say, the last 100 years and the fall in nutritional value in our food through processes and farming practice.
Good question, Paul.
Yeah, well, I think certainly, again, dietary factors are an important cause of cancer, and we have seen, we've seen several things. We've seen a fall in some types of cancers as opposed to an increase. We've actually seen some types of what we call gastric cancer, which is cancer of the actual stomach itself, where, you know, you eat food and it goes in the esophagus and then the stomach. We've seen a fall in gastric cancer over the last 30, 40 years, and that's probably largely due to things like the proper use of foods and proper handling of foods and reduction of some of the additives to food. So that's an example of where cancers are falling. I don't think obesity, for example, and physical inactivity are thought to be environmental factors or lifestyle factors, which are leading, which if physical inactivity or being excessively overweight or excessive alcohol intake and so on are thought to be contributors to an increased incidence of cancer with time. But probably the most important cause of the increased incidence over time that we've seen relates to the ageing of the population.
Yeah, okay. And also you'd think now we've got the chance to eat better than any time in history. We perhaps just choose not to.
Yep.
Kathleen, good morning.
Good morning, Rod. Good morning, Professor. Could you give us a little bit more information about ovarian cancer? One of my daughters has been diagnosed with what they call clear cell carcinoma.
Right.
Very, very hard to pick up. Luckily, she's caught it twice that it's reared its head. She's picked it up early. And also, she's been told it's mostly a cancer that affects Asian women, in particular Japanese women. Now, here's our daughter with it, and a very, very fit girl, very careful of what she eats and everything like that, but here she is with it. And it's not a cancer that gets much help from chemo, but she has undergone chemo for a short time. But other than that, it's just a three-monthly checkup that's going to be of help to her.
How old was she, Kathleen?
When she first got it, she was 46.
Okay. John?
Yes, so I was certainly sorry to hear the news. But, in fact, ovarian cancer is one of those tumours that is hard to pick up early, and there's been lots of discussion of whether we can develop some screening programs to pick ovarian cancer up early, because it because of where it's located, it can sometimes appear and then grow and be quite sizable before people start to develop symptoms. It's one of those tumours that does, in general, without commenting about your daughter's case specifically, certainly one of those tumours in which surgery and chemotherapy are used, and in general can often cure people even when they're quite advanced. So certainly that the fact that she's doing well, glad to hear, and is certainly seen with ovarian cancer, but of course that's not always the case.
Thank you.
We really wish you the very best, Kathleen. Look, we'll get to Wendy, Helen and Jenny in a moment, and Billy as well. But Zoran is on the road. G'day, Zoran.
G'day, guys. How are you going?
Good, mate. You've just had an operation.
Yeah, just just on 12 months ago. It was actually in June 2011.
Righty, yep.
I'm actually, you can probably hear me in the truck of my truck driver. And yes. The operation was a squamous cell carcinoma.
Right.
A very young bloke, and at the age of 37, never been a smoker, never been a drinker.
Yep.
And I had squamous cell carcinoma. And I'm sure the doctor knows what that is.
Yep.
And nobody knows why I got that. The doctors tell me, and I didn't actually get treated with chemotherapy, but I was treated with radiotherapy.
Right.
I had 7 weeks of radiotherapy every day. I had heavy bar or heavy grating, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
I have got a heavy, and it was all inside my mouth. And I've got a very big piece of the inside of my mouth, the maxilla, missing inside, and they've built me up with a prosthesis, which, look, I'm still in a lot of pain, a lot of medication, They tell me that we're in 99%, we think that we've got it, you've got it on time, you know, no one can guarantee that it's
of
not going to come back. But why did it come there?
Yeah.
We don't know.
All right. Zoran, thank you so much for your call, and I certainly wish you the best. Why is it, John, that the cancer does develop? In some people, you hear about people who never smoked in their life and yet they get lung cancer. Why does it happen?
Yeah, well, that's the $64 million question, as they say, right? And we don't really know. Look, cancers of the mouth, which I think is what was Zoran was describing, sometimes are related to, well, for example, are more common in smokers and sometimes viral infections.
Yeah.
But in general, the question of why one person gets a tumour and another, at the end of the day, all we can really say is that other than those factors that we understand about genetic factors, we understand about lifestyle factors and environmental factors, and yet the same person may... you'd be exposed to environmental factors and one person gets it and one doesn't. And we just fall back to saying there are a lot of abnormalities occurring in our genetic in cells all the time, and there's a healing process, but sometimes within cells. So there's an abnormality that occurs, the cell dies or the cell heals itself and life continues. But those mutations are occurring at random, and sometimes they occur in a critical gene, and that gene, you know, just by chance, then is not able to be repaired or leads to this uncontrolled growth that we talked about. So very hard to know why one, you know, that you might say, well, okay, there's environmental factors, but two people exposed to the same factors, one gets cancer and one doesn't. What's going on? And it's very difficult to know.
Wendy, good morning.
Hello there, Rod and Professor John. I'm insulin dependent, diabetic, and on the back of my mind now for quite a while, I've been hearing different people getting cancer of the pancreas. I'm wondering, being a diabetic, is it readily people
that
are diabetic, do they... seem to get it more so?
That's a very good question, Wendy.
Wendy, so that, it is a good question. And I think that certainly the there is an association, shall we say, between pancreas cancer and diabetes. There are an awful lot of diabetics around, insulin-dependent diabetics or not, who don't get pancreas cancer. So I certainly wouldn't want you to think that because you're a diabetic, you will get pancreas cancer. But sometimes there are conditions within the pancreas, inflammatory conditions, that that lead to the dysfunction or the inability of the pancreas to function properly, which, of course, is where... And that leads to diabetes. And those same conditions can result or at least associated with pancreas cancer. So I would call it more an association. I certainly don't think if you're a diabetic, you will get pancreas cancer. That's certainly not the case.
But, I mean...
Dr. John, Professor, I've already had 2 attacks of pancreatitis.
Right.
And, you know, and that sort of... has twigged everything,
sure.
And I've kept it to myself. I haven't said anything to my GP or anything, and I thought, well, you know, I'll see how I go. But, I mean, I've had two attacks.
Well, I think you should tell your doctor.
Yeah.
John?
Yes, yes, I absolutely agree. I think that your doctor is your advisor here, and we'll investigate if he or she thinks it's appropriate. So certainly it's an example of where, you know, the wisdom and experience of a good GP is really critical.
Okay, Wendy, again, thank you very much for that. And again, if somebody feels that maybe there is a concern there, is there something they can do when it comes to pancreatic cancer? I mean, is there a test for it?
Well, the way we normally screen, we don't really screen in a sort of population sense, but the way we'd look for it is usually with a CAT scan. So sometimes you can do an ultrasound, and that ultrasound can be done right. as an internal ultrasound, so what we call through endoscopy, so putting one of those, you look inside the stomach and so on, you can look for it that way, or CT scan. Those are the sorts of tests that are used. MRI scans also used.
Okay. I'm terribly sorry we're taking a little while to get to some callers, but Helen is next. Hello, Helen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Young people, osteosarcoma, why should it attack a perfectly healthy, athletic 16-year-old suddenly out of the blue? And he's had a year of excellent treatment, superb treatment, couldn't be better, was clear about 2 months ago, and now has secondaries in his lungs.
Yeah, Helen, sorry about that.
Yeah, it's sad to hear that. Look, I would say that one of the things, I don't think we know why a healthy 16-year-old develops osteosarcoma. And, you know, there's been suggestions that it may relate to trauma and so on. But really, I think that's we just don't understand that other than the general factors I'd said earlier. But what I think your question does illustrate, and I could use it to make a more general point, Helen, is that when we talked about the cancers that are more common in the community, and talk about prostate and bowel and lung and so on, it depends on the age. The average age of a person getting cancer is in their late 60s, so 67, 68, that sort of time frame. So when we're talking about young people getting cancer, this is very much very uncommon. It does occur, it's known, and there are good treatment programs available. But it's a certain type. But on the other hand, 16-year-olds don't get prostate cancer generally, and they don't get lung cancer and bowel cancer and so on. So there are certain cancers that are more common in certain age groups, and bone cancer being one of them in younger people. But osteosarcoma, unfortunately, is one of those that occurs in young people, and there are good programs, and hopefully you still have some effective treatment, you'll get better.
Okay, Helen, and thank you so much for that. Jenny, good morning.
Good morning, Rod and John.
Good morning.
Just want to ask you, my cousin's been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she's a fitness expert, and she loves diet and everything, but she's decided to cure herself with the power of her mind.
Okay.
And I just wanted to know, what are her chances?
Again, I'll just point out that John doesn't know this case specifically and can only make general comments, but I mean, we often hear this sort of story, or people choose to go with what they describe as alternative therapies. John, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, look, I think, I guess it depends exactly what's happening with your cousin, but I would say that in general, there are very effective treatments for breast cancer, and many, many patients are cured. In fact, the vast majority of patients will live natural lives, or at least live many, many years with breast cancer, or sometimes it won't recur at all, which is as I say, still the majority when it's picked up early. Having said that, the mind, understanding the patient's psychological needs and helping them adjust to the diagnosis and to the treatment is a really important part of the management of a patient with cancer. So I wouldn't say, but when you say, we're going to use the mind to cure the cancer, and if that means that she's not going to use the anti-cancer therapies that are available, then of course that's more risky, I suppose, because these are established treatments, and the ability of alternative approaches, and when I'm using the word alternative specifically to mean where that approach is used and not conventional treatments.
Yeah,
that's where I think we feel that they should not be used. You know, the complementary therapies can be used to help people who are having traditional therapies or conventional therapies, but not as an alternative.
This is the thing, isn't it? I mean, Jenny, your cousin, I think it is, she can use the power of her mind along with the cancer treatment.
I begged her to go and use orthodox treatment, but she won't. And she's beautiful, and she's about 50, and she's got two children in their early 20s. So sad.
Jenny, thank you very much, though, for bringing that up. But is that something you come across a lot, John?
Well, it's very common for in the Australian community for people to be using complementary therapies in addition to conventional therapies.
But no therapy at all?
Yeah, that's very uncommon these days. And although some people, you know, occasionally, I mean, hopefully what might happen in this example is that she may start and then change her mind. So, the initial reaction.
I understand that people are afraid and they don't know what to do about it. But, you know, the earlier the better, surely, with treatment. Billy is next. G'day, Billy.
Good morning. Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you for waiting.
Mine is a prostate problem. For years I've been going under the toilet, urinating 20 to 30 times a day.
Dear.
And going along to my doctor, and my PSA has been all right. Eventually got sick of it and went.
Yeah.
And the doctor sent me on to it. I had an ultrasound and went on to a specialist, and he said, yeah, you have an enlarged prostate. And he recommended the TURP procedure. He put me on Duodart, and for the first month, I didn't agree with me real well, and I rang him up, so they put me on the waiting list. And since then, 2 months have passed, and the Duodart seems to be working better. I'm sleeping, more, not getting up so much during the night. And I've heard not good things about the TURP procedure.
Okay. Well, I will again point out that John's advice is of a general nature and not specifically for you. But what do you know about that, John?
Well, look, as we said, prostate cancer is common, and there are various approaches that are used. I think that what I'd suggest, Billy, is that you do talk to the surgeon about this. You know, you've got time to have a discussion and understand what the side effects are and what you might experience. But certainly, surgery is an important treatment for prostate cancer. And, you know, what we're trying to do here and what I'm sure you want, as everybody wants, is that this is cured. And that requires your specialist team, you know, the surgeon, your GP, and maybe even the radiation oncologist to be working together to try and maximise the chance of cure. But you've got to talk to them, and you've got to say, you know, what are the side effects, what will I experience? And the other thing that I would just say very quickly to add on to that, you know, you're not alone here. There are a number of men who have been through similar experiences. And through the Prostate Cancer Foundation of Australia, for example, or other organisations, you will be able to make contact with them and talk to them about the sort of things that they've experienced, because that often provides a lot of comfort for people.
I again wish you the very best, Billy. And just time for Faye and Phil. We'll start with Faye. Hello. Good morning.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, Faye.
I live in a farming community in southern Tasmania.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my late husband died. He was he actually lived a lot longer than most people, because he had cancer, the pancreatic cancer, the bowel, the liver, and went into all his vital organs.
Yeah.
But he did live 20 months, which is quite a miracle. But my question is, as a doctor, I heard that Tasmanians had the high, I don't know if it's true or not, had the highest
rate of cancer.
Cancer.
Yeah.
Now, we and I've always... And when we now look around the community, there's been a lot of people die of cancer. We have the planes go over our heads.
Yeah.
We've got the island, because we're, you know, I suppose we're about 120 by 120, aren't we? We're not that big. And we have the winds, and then we have the aerial spraying, and we have the runoff from the farms.
Right.
Now would that affect? Would that affect us of having so much cancer?
Thank you for the question, Faye. Is Tasmania worse for cancer than anywhere else?
Look, I don't. I think there are regional differences in where cancers occur, and partly that relates to the type of the communities that are there. But it also partly relates to sometimes this is confused with access to treatment. So you know, late diagnosis in communities in which there's not adequate access to medical care. So late diagnosis leads to worse outcomes. So it's often hard to sort of tease all those things apart.
Good
but
point.
I think, you know, Australia is up there in international terms with, you know, unfortunately, cancers like bowel cancer and so forth. So
okay.
So there are regional differences.
Yeah, so if you're living in rural or regional areas, maybe less likely to have it diagnosed early. And our final call is Phil. Correct. G'day, Phil.
Hello.
Yes, mate.
Rob, yeah, look, I've got a couple of questions regarding the cervical cancer and which is caused by the papillomavirus, I believe. Is that right?
Good morning, Phil. By certain subtypes of the papillomavirus, not all of them, but that's correct. It's related at least to that sort of viral infection in people that are younger.
Phil, we only have really a minute or so to go.
I've just got a couple of quick questions.
One question, if
you
can.
I know there's a program in regard to vaccinating young girls. There's less likelihood of getting cervical cancer. What about young boys? I mean, is there any relationship between papillomavirus and possibly prostate cancer in later life? And would it be beneficial for a young boy to be vaccinated?
All right, John.
Good question. So certainly there has been a lot of discussion about vaccinating boys, more about the life cycle of the virus, I guess, and I'm not aware of any specific data around papillomavirus and prostate cancer per se, but there certainly are discussion about some of the papillomaviruses and some of the oral cancers, for example, that occur. But in the life cycle of a virus, you know, in between, and given that some of the sexual transmission that may occur with that virus, so that's where there's been discussion about vaccinating boys.
Look, this may be a very difficult question to answer, but are you familiar with genetic repair factors and the past work of Anton Nieper, I think it is? Any developments along these lines?
I don't know that specific person, but certainly repair of DNA. So DNA is the basic building block of our genes, and repair of DNA is going on all the time. And when there are abnormalities in the repair of DNA, that predisposes people to certain types of cancer. Mm-hmm. And bowel cancers, for example, and breast cancers are probably the two most prominent examples of where abnormalities in the repair gene processes predispose to those conditions.
There's so much more we could have talked about and we don't have time this morning, but hopefully we'll do it again. Professor, thank you so much for your time and your expertise. And I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All the best.
Thank you, Professor John Zaltzberg at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne.